This year is multiculturalism. That was just for the tape, though. So I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, guys. I want to take a look. I want to take a look, at least for this afternoon, for an hour, at something called multiculturalism. I'll start by telling you what I mean by that word. Different people mean different things by it, and it would be helpful to know we're talking about the same subject. And then we'll analyze it to see what kind of validity it has. As a first shot, we'll modify it in a minute, but as a first shot, let's mean by multiculturalism this. All cultures have equal value, equal meaningfulness, equal authority, equal truth, equal appropriateness. Cultures are equal in all important respects. No one can say that one culture is superior to another culture. All cultures are equal and should be treated as equal. Give me about 3 minutes to finish the first thought and change the formulation, and then I'll be glad to take questions. Now, people try to back this up in the following way. Suppose you tried to judge one culture better than another culture. What would you use to do the judging? What kind of criteria would you use? What kind of factors would you think were relevant? Wouldn't you have to take your criteria from some culture? After all, we're all products of culture. And we've all absorbed to a great extent the values of our culture. If someone in culture A wants to evaluate which is better, culture A or culture B, one of which is his own, won't he be hopelessly prejudiced because he's coming from culture A and he's using the standards of culture A to compare culture A with culture B? Or imagine he comes from culture A and he's trying to judge which is better, culture B or culture C. Then he won't necessarily be prejudiced, but it'll just be incompetent. Why should the standards of culture A be used to evaluate culture B? That being the case, it will be just incompetent, irrelevant, immaterial, absurd, nonsense, to try to judge that one culture is superior to another culture, and therefore we take the position that all cultures are equal. Okay? Now, as I've said this is clearly nonsense. It's clearly nonsense because if you can't use any neutral standards to evaluate cultures, then you can't even say they're equal. Because saying they're equal is an evaluation. When you say A is better than B, that's an evaluation. And when you say A and B are equal in value, that's also an evaluation. You can't back up equality saying, I can't make any judgments. Because equality is a judgment. So really, if this is going to be consistent, which is a non-trivial condition, if it's going to be consistent, then what should be said is, since we're using the standards of a particular culture for all our judgments, and we can't use the standards of one judgment to evaluate another judgment, we can't use the standards of one culture to evaluate another culture, we should then simply not compare cultures at all. Not to say that one is better than the other, not to say that they're equal. Just recognize they're apples and oranges. They're incomparable. Incommensurate, to use a fancy term. And certainly, we shouldn't say that one is superior to another. Okay, that's how we're going to use as the formulation of multiculturalism. Are we together so far? Okay, now, I have a recommendation to make. When people are discussing philosophy, it gets very heady. We talk in very abstract terms. We're talking about principles that apply to the whole world and have large-scale consequences and all the rest. In order to get clear what we're talking about, I recommend that we take these very grand ideas and try to apply them to very simple, everyday, trivial circumstances. At least where we know the thing we're applying it to, we know it well, we're confident that we understand it, and see how they apply. I find this exercise often has surprising results. Sometimes, the principles don't apply the way you expected. Sometimes you can't see how they apply at all. And that gives you considerable insight into what you were talking about. First thing you realize that you didn't know what you were talking about. And then you realize you got to work some to get to a subject that can be discussed sensibly. So let's try this. The principle is the standards, criteria of one culture can't be applied to another culture. Let's apply it to very simple, concrete cases and see how far we get. I'm visiting the South Sea Islands. And on this island, they do a lot of things cooperatively. In particular, they build houses cooperatively. They all get together, put up the walls and the roof, and they pave their floors. And here's how they pave the floor. They have a quarry with paving stones. And all the paving stones are the same size. And when they put up the walls and the roof, then they send down people to the quarry, and the people come up with as many stones as they can carry, and then they pave the floor. If they need more, they send more people down. If they have too many, then they take them back. That's how they do it. So I watch this, and then I say to them, I'm going to show you something. Something that's going to amaze you, and it's going to make your life a lot more efficient. I'm going to reduce your effort by a considerable amount. So they put off the walls and the roof, and I measure the walls. One wall is 6 feet long, and the other wall is 4 feet long. And their paving stones are 1 foot square. So I choose 12 people, and I say, listen, all 12 of you guys go down to the quarry. Each one of you pick up a stone in one hand and come back. And they do that, and guess what? They have exactly the right number of stones to fit the floor. They don't have to go back for a second trip, and they don't have to take any extra stones back. It's the exact right number, because the last time I checked, 4 times 6 was 24. Could this work? But how could it work? Geometry was invented in Greece and Egypt and is a Western cultural product. How can it work in a South Sea Island? Why isn't it apples and oranges? Aren't we just applying the principle of one culture to another culture? But it should be obvious that it'll work, right? Okay, let's try another one. I'm there in the South Sea Islands, and a native doubles over in pain, excruciating pain in his abdomen. And I take out my x-ray machine, without which I never travel, and I x-ray his abdomen, find that he's got a burst appendix. And I take out my scalpels and my anesthesia, without which I never travel, and I surgically remove his appendix, and he recovers. Could that happen? Sure it could happen. But look, the x-ray machine was made in Chicago, and the surgical technique was developed in New York, and the anesthesia was manufactured in London. How could these Western cultural products apply in the South Seas? Isn't it apples and oranges? But it's clearly not apples and oranges. It seems clear that it'll apply very easily. Let's try another one. In this South Sea island, everybody provides for all his own needs, except for houses. Aside from that, everybody makes his own clothes, everybody makes his own weapons, everyone grows his own plants, you know, agricultural food, everybody traps his own animals, and therefore they live at a bare subsistence level because there's no division of labor. So I say to them, here's a way to make your lives much more comfortable and much more productive. Divide up the population and have people go into full-time efforts in one area. They'll become very efficient at it. They'll learn from experience better ways to do it. And your culture as a whole will be much more productive. Now, division of labor is a Western cultural product. And they don't have it in the South Seas. Couldn't it work? Wouldn't their lives be much more productive if they adopt this Western cultural practice? Now, here you might have a problem. Their psychology or their culture might not allow for cooperative practice in this way. That might happen. So it might not apply in the sense that they may be reluctant to apply it. But if they adopt it, won't it become more productive? Of course it'll become more productive. Let's talk about logic. If you flip a coin, you're betting on the coin, and it comes up 6 times in a row heads, are you willing to give higher odds on tails next time? Well, a lot of people are. Because they say, you know, if it's a fair coin, you've used up six heads. So it's time for tails. You know, I mean, like, tails have to even out. And if they have to even out, so then the next few will probably be more tails, right? That's called the gambler's fallacy. It's a well-known mathematical fallacy, or logical fallacy. After all, either the coin really is fair, in which case the probability of each flip is one half, period, or it isn't fair, and if it isn't fair and you got six heads in a row, then it's probably biased in favor of heads. Giving higher odds on tails is always wrong. Now let's imagine that you have a whole culture that will give higher odds on tails. That's just the way they are. Could it be that because the whole culture is doing it that way, they're not making a mistake? Because it's a whole culture, you see. And it's just our culture versus their culture. And our mathematical or logical argument that it's a mistake is just a Western cultural product. How could it apply to a South Sea Island? Isn't it clear that if they bet that way on the weather, or they bet that way on war, or they bet that way on raising turnips, they're going to lose? Because it's a logical mistake. So here's another example, this is example number four, of how a Western cultural product can apply to another culture and increase the productivity, the success of that culture, and we're not blocked by some grand principle that you can't move from culture to culture. It just isn't true. Now let's go in the opposite direction. What about acupuncture? Acupuncture was developed in China, and although there's a lot of nonsense that they will teach you about acupuncture, about energies in the body, which can't be measured, of course, and all sorts of psychological effects and all the rest, but as anesthesia, it is documented as extremely useful. There were double-blind experiments done on acupuncture, and it works as anesthesia. But how could that be? I mean, it was developed in China, and is being applied in the West. How can an Eastern cultural product apply in the West? But it doesn't seem to be any difficulty here. How about meditation? Meditation is a deeply cultural product of India. How could it work in New York or in San Francisco? Well, San Francisco is another planet. But all right, you know, Iowa and Florida. How could it work? It works. Why? Because these cultural products, because the fact that they're created by one culture as an expression of that culture's view of things, doesn't mean that it disconnects from other cultures. I want you to know there's a worldwide craze now for Shakespeare. Shakespeare is being performed in deepest Africa, in Shanghai, in India, all over the world. And it's wildly popular. This is 17th century Britain. Maybe I should say England. What has that got to do with Shanghai? I just heard now about a production which is half English and half Mandarin, with subtitles, where, you know, so that both peoples can read it, and it goes over extremely well. Because although Shakespeare was writing it in pre-Victorian England, he wrote about the human condition. And he was able to describe elements of the human condition which are common all over the world. So it doesn't seem like there's some bar to applying one culture to another. And indeed, even in concluding that one culture is superior to another in certain respects. Why would the rest of the world have adopted jeans and Coke unless they felt that it was superior to their own clothing and drinks? How come surgery is exportable, or meditation is exportable, or acupuncture is exportable, unless we feel that we'll be better off if we use acupuncture and meditation, and they feel they'll be better off if they use surgery? That means they've got something that's better than what we have, and will improve us if we take it. So where is there a bar in principle to judging that what one culture does is superior to another culture? How do cultures change in imitation of others? Democracy is making something of a comeback from the Middle Ages when it didn't exist. And it is spreading in certain parts of the globe. Of course, the United States is not doing a good job of shoving it down Arabs' throats. There may be a lesson there. But in other places, it is making some comeback. How does that happen? Isn't it that people with a particular form of government look at the democracies and say, hey, they've got something like money and power, and also a certain way of making decisions, and maybe a certain quality of life, and independence or something, and it's worth imitating, which means Now I'm going back on what I said at the very beginning. It means that if I'm sitting in culture A, and I'm using my standards to compare myself with B, I might not be prejudiced in favor of myself. Indeed, I might look at myself and say, they're better off than we are. And therefore we should change to be more like them. The fact that I'm using my standards doesn't mean that I'm going to win. I could be using my standards and losing the comparison. So it seems to me that across the board here, we have lots of examples where you can use the standards from one culture to evaluate what's going on in another culture. There's no difficulty with that. There's no bar to that. The idea that we started with, that cultures can't be judged objectively to be better or worse or equal, seems to be simply incorrect in many cases. Now, I haven't spoken about values, and I'm coming to that. But before we get to values, I'm happy to take questions. Yeah.
I do acupuncture myself, and I'm just trying to relate it, but just when the West took on acupuncture, it might be that they've taken on acupuncture because they see the benefit of the painkilling effect it has, but it might be that they know it works, but they don't believe it works for the same reason that the Eastern religion thinks.
That is surely correct. That is surely correct.
In the sense that they might not actually be taking on the cultural aspect of that acupuncture. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
I agree with you.
They're taking on the modality, but they're not actually necessarily recognising the benefit of that culture, because they're saying, yeah, this modality works, but we don't believe in the meridians and the energy system. We believe it's stimulating the nerve endings. So the Westerners have taken acupuncture and tried to explain it through a Western medical viewpoint.
I agree with you wholly, and that's why I said that the what's written about acupuncture in the East is largely without merit. I agree with you. I was just taking I appreciate what you say.
I don't know if I could apply that example though to other examples. Maybe we do take things from other cultures, or people take things from other cultures, but maybe they'll take the thing but try and put their own cultural viewpoint on that.
I think you're right. I think you're right, and it'll vary from case to case, the extent to which you'll be successful in doing that.
Yeah.
I think with meditation it'll be much harder, because
when it comes to the body is so kind of, so much we don't understand about the body.
Correct. We don't understand the body, and you're absolutely right about that. My point was only, remember, I was considering a very radical position. The position is nothing created in one culture can apply to another culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Now here we have something which half applies. That's already an exception to their rule. Yeah.
Going back to the gambler's fallacy that you were talking about, on one side, the next coin toss will be probability of a half, because it's independent. But on the other side, can you say that if the dice is thrown six times, then it's going to be six times more probable that you're going to have one tail and five heads than it is going to be to have five heads.
Are we talking about dice now? There's no tails and heads in the dice. If you know, before you throw it, you predict what it will be.
I guess if you look at it after the fifth time,
yes,
or the sixth time,
yes,
and it's been five heads so far,
yes. Absolutely not. Because as you said, every flip is independent. You said that yourself. Remember, you're dealing with probability here, right? Probability allows for improbable things to happen. And it may be that from now on, it'll be 50-50. And in this string, you had an improbable string of five heads. Right?
If you look at the end result of the sixth flips,
yes. Only when you haven't got the five heads in front of you. What you're dealing with is a conditional probability. Given that I have five heads, what's the probability of six heads versus the probability of five heads and a tails? 50-50. That's why I asked you if you're predicting before you start. If you're predicting before you start, then it's a different probability. I agree. Once you've got five done, that's passed already. Right? Then just tacking one at the end, conditional probability won't make any difference. I mean, we're getting stuck in a thing that's not really the point that I'm trying to get to. Yeah.
All the things that you used in examples before were systems. So it's a system of choosing how many stones. They're all systems that would apply across any human being whatsoever. So like x-raying the human body, choosing kind of like a mathematical equation. You didn't use anything to do with ethics.
I said a moment ago that I haven't gotten to values yet, and I'm coming to that next. I said that. I don't know if systems is the right word here. I mean, systems doesn't mean good, but it's facts rather than values. And then in that terms of divine, I'm coming to values. So I agree with you, but now notice that the differences between cultures plays no role in that comment. What you say would be true within one culture. If there was only one culture in the world, what you say would be just as true.
Right, but if you're asking why that culture somewhere else doesn't accept our like perfected forms of logic, whatever we cross, it seems like, you know, obviously that's like the way you should understand things, but they don't understand it, but then, you know, or like modern science, but modern science is often wrong. So it's,
One second. You made two comments. One is we need to understand their goals, and the other is that we're often wrong.
Right.
Now, the second comment, I'm just remarking, the second comment that we're often wrong has nothing to do with the differences between cultures.
Well, but when you're trying to judge a culture based on their methods or whatever, I mean, maybe their methods are actually better.
Well,
oh,
maybe, of course. That just means that I could be wrong about anything. I could be wrong about tomorrow's weather. I could be wrong about my mathematics. I could be wrong about other cultures. It's just another subject about which I could be wrong. But the differences of cultures has nothing to do with this source of error. It's just that anything I do could be mistaken. That's correct. Now, as far as their goals is concerned, that's coming up. I think that's quite important. They might have different goals from mine. Still, my judgment that this is how you get to this goal will be correct. And it'll be correct for them also. They might just say, I know that's how you get to that goal, but I don't care to go there, so I don't do it. I'm not telling them that they ought to do it. I'm just saying, this is how you get there. So if I'm just making a judgment on how to get there, then it doesn't apply. Let's try values. Can you really talk about values from culture to culture? Now, first of all, let me point out what the multiculturalist here is flirting with. About 15 years ago, or maybe 20 years ago, there was a speech at the United Nations by the representative from Saudi Arabia, and he said, "We applaud the current Western commitment to multiculturalism because now you'll get off our backs about how we treat women." Yes, in Saudi Arabia, women are second-class citizens. Well, actually, they're sixth-class citizens. Applaud our culture. Celebrate the multi in multiculturalism. When you have your multiculturalism week on campus, don't forget the Saudi Arabia booth with the women chained to the stove. Right? Or what did you think? Multiculturalism meant New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Denver? That's your multiculturalism? Or a fellow named Suharto, who nobody remembers anymore, who used to be the dictator of Indonesia, who said, "Don't export your Western rights to us. We don't need them." That's what he said to the United Nations Doctrine of Universal Human Rights. He said, "Don't export your culture to us. We live in a different part of the world, we have a different culture, and we don't need them." Now, are you really going to put up with a culture that systematically disadvantages certain people on the grounds that it's a different culture and every culture has its own values? I think maybe things are going to get sticky now. How far do you want to go? They asked a co-ed at Stanford about clitorectomy. There are African tribes that remove the clitoris of female babies.
That's not even all in all.
I mean, they take more than that.
They cut out the entire thing, and then in a lot of cases they'll cut it, cut lips together, and then sew it up so they heal together, and then each time the husband wants to have sex with her, he'll cut her open.
Cut okay. I'm even more horrified. So now they ask this co-ed how far does your multiculturalism go? Does it go so far to approve of this culture's way of treating their females, since it's another culture? She was in severe agony over this question, and then she cracked and said, yes, I guess I have to approve of what the culture is doing because it's another culture. Isn't that shocking? Now, I think a sane person ought to think again that maybe something's going wrong here. If that isn't horrific enough for you, what about the Nazis? Imagine a correspondence between two cousins, one living in Chicago, one living in Berlin, in 1943 by secret courier. You know, and the one in Chicago writes, we hear unbelievably atrocious things about the most cultured country on the earth, systematically killing out a whole nation of people. I'm sure it isn't true. And the guy in Berlin writes back and says, on the contrary, we have the ability to see the future, and we know that in 40 years, you and the West are going to believe in multiculturalism, and we have a different culture. And the guy in Berlin writes, do you in Chicago have a criminal code? You have police force and courts, and you enforce a criminal code? He writes back, yes. So the guy in Berlin says, what do you call a criminal? How do you define a criminal? He says, well, murder and rape and assault and battery and, you know, various crimes. And the guy in Chicago says, that's how your culture defines criminal. We define it as follows: murder and rape and assault and battery and being Jewish. We have a different definition of criminal. You have your definition, we have our definition, right? And since we're a different culture, you know, it's just differences of culture. Now, I think at this point, a person should start to feel uncomfortable. So I feel uncomfortable. Am I really locking myself into a position where I can't criticize a whole culture that has different values? And let's push it another step. Can you criticize your own culture's values? How can you do that? If these are the values of the culture, then there's the values of the culture. And they're right for that reason, because they're your culture's values. How do cultures go through cultural revolutions where they have substantial change in values? Isn't it because at the outset, a small minority begins to feel something's wrong and talk about it and discuss it and preach it and eventually convince everyone? Why doesn't the everyone just say, you've made an elementary error, you know? This is the culture's values, so they're right for the culture. He can appeal to something outside the current set of values, and the people say, wait a minute, maybe we've got it wrong. Okay, so it does seem like there's something wrong here. Now, I want to explain to you a way in which you can see value universals. This goes back to something I said in the last hour, but I'm going to make it much more careful now and elaborate it more. First of all, there's a limit to mere disagreement. I believe A. Somebody says, I don't. I think A is wrong. There's a limit to how far that can go. You can't always do that. For certain types of A, that kind of exchange becomes unintelligible, absurd, unimaginable. If I say I prefer supply-side economics, and the other guy says supply-side economics is nuts, we can understand that. But suppose I say there are tables. The other guy says, no, there aren't. How's that go? There aren't any tables? Should we say, oh, okay, so I think there are tables and you don't think there are tables? That's it, you know, people think different things. I don't think we'll take it that way. What do you mean there are no tables? I mean, what's that? You're sitting on one, you know, you're sitting next to one. How could you say there are no tables? So either the guy's nuts or the guy's not serious. Or, by T-A-B-L-E, he doesn't mean what I mean, which is often enough the case. We discover that our concepts are different. But just, I have a view, and he has a view. Imagine he says to me, I know what your view is, your opinion, your belief, your theory, your hypothesis. Your theory, your hypothesis is that there are tables. I have a different theory, a different hypothesis. Mine is that there are no tables. I think we will respond, excuse me, this isn't an opinion, a belief, a theory, a hypothesis. It's just an obvious fact that there are tables, you know. There's need a theory or a hypothesis. You see them, you touch them. To say he has a different theory is not describing my world. It's not a theory in my world. It's just an open fact. So there's a limit to mere disagreement. I'm not going to tolerate mere disagreement because, number one, he looks like me. Number two, he has a fairly successful life. He survived to the age of 25. And he's gotten an education. And he knows how to spend money and write checks. He knows how to fly in airplanes. So his intelligence and his general information has got to be similar to mine. How could he not know that there are tables? This is not possible. Supply side economics is very controversial. I know there are arguments for and against, and it's easy to understand that people might disagree about that. Disagree about whether or not there are tables is just beyond belief. Someone says, I know that your theory is that 7 plus 5 is 12. Well, I have a different theory. It's 11. He's put himself beyond understanding. In philosophy, particularly philosophy of language, this is called the principle of charity. Interpret the other guy to make him as human as possible. If he says something and you have to interpret him as being completely out of touch with reality, then you're probably not getting him right. And you have to re-examine his words, re-evaluate his words. Because it's just not credible that a normal person living in my world could be unaware that there are tables. For any fact that's obvious, now I'm going to say it more carefully. For any fact that's obvious to all, mere disagreement will not be tolerated. You think A, I think A is false. We're not going to tolerate that. We're going to reinterpret him or declare him incompetent in some way. But there could be principal disagreement. Not mere disagreement, but principal disagreement. To have a principal disagreement, he'd have to tell us a story. He'd have to say, look, I know why it's obvious to you that there are tables. I know where you're getting it from. But I happen to know something you don't know. And given what I know, I can explain why it's obvious to you and also why that's wrong. Well, if he tells me a story like that, then I should listen. That's not mere disagreement. He's not just opting to disagree. He has a whole explanation of where the mistake might come in. For example, he says, I've been doing some hiking in the Andes Mountains in a completely unexplored area, and I came across a crashed spacecraft. And I discovered some of their records, and I've put together the fact that they took over the world's communications media, and they projected a hypnotic suggestion, and the content of the hypnotic suggestion was that there are tables. And they have succeeded in hypnotizing the whole human race into believing that there are tables. Well, now I might have to reconsider. Yeah, it's obvious to me and everybody else that there are tables, but maybe it's obvious because we've been hypnotized. So then, maybe I should go to the Andes and look, or examine the artifacts to see if they're really extraterrestrial, or, you know. That's why I say, principal disagreement is possible, but not mere disagreement. Person can't simply say, I just say there are no tables. He can't do that because common experience makes that obvious. So, understand me well. I'm not saying everything that's obvious is true. I'm saying everything that's obvious is true. I'm making a more subtle point. Everything that's obvious can't be merely disagreed with. You can't just opt for another position. Now, that's true about physical reality. It's true about mathematics. And I think it's true about ethics as well. Let's take, it's wrong to torture small children for fun. Why am I putting the for fun? It's a quiz based on the last hour. Why am I putting in the for fun? Yeah, but why am I putting for fun? Wrong. I'm avoiding conflicting values. The only thing we're talking about is the wrongness of torturing small children. For fun means there's no conflicting moral value. Right? So it makes it a one-dimensional judgment. Now, imagine someone who says, I know your theory, your hypothesis, your opinion, your belief that it's wrong to torture small children for fun, but I have a different theory, a different hypothesis, a different opinion, a different belief. I believe that it's perfectly all right to torture small children for fun. I think we're going to react to that exactly the way we react to the person who says there are no tables. This is too obvious to miss. Right and wrong have subtleties. Right and wrong have controversial applications, but this isn't one of them. This is so obvious that if he misses this, something's gone wrong. Either he and I don't mean the same thing by wrong, or children, or torture, or fun, or, you know, some miscommunication here, or he isn't serious, or he isn't mentally competent. Something's gone off, because this is too obvious to just make a mistake about. Now, there's a set of moral facts which are obvious like that. The one that I mentioned last hour. If you've made a promise and fulfilling it will cost you nothing, you ought to fulfill it. No one will disagree with that. If someone disagrees with that, he doesn't know what a promise is. Or he's not serious. Or he's, you know, not mentally competent. It's too obvious a fact to be missed unless someone had a whole reasoned disagreement. He has some theory about how it is we came to this and why it could be mistaken. But without that, just to opt for a different position is beyond credibility. Now, let's apply this to different cultures. I'm borrowing an argument, a famous argument by Willard Van Orman Quine, who would be horrified if he knew I was using his argument for this purpose. But I'm using it anyway. Let's imagine that we visit another culture and we try to understand their culture. One of the things we're going to have to do is translate their language. So we build up a dictionary by watching them, interacting with them. They make sounds, we make sounds. Let's suppose the native says, gobbly, gobbly, gobbly gook. So we take out our dictionary, and according to the dictionary, he's saying something obviously false. Isn't the right move to question the dictionary? Instead of assuming that he's some kind of insane person or some kind of mental incompetent, isn't the right thing to do to question the dictionary? Claude Lévi-Strauss was a noted sociologist in the 20th century, even though he was French, and he claimed to have discovered pre-logical peoples. Peoples whose minds don't work with logic. He claimed such people could say, it is raining here and now, and it is not raining here and now, with a straight face, and just accept it. Well, Quine said, we have another alternative. And that is, you haven't understood what he said. After all, when you build up a dictionary about someone's language, that's really a theory. I'm trying to understand what he means. Here's my theory about what he means. What's the evidence for the theory? The evidence for the theory is, if I translate him this way, I can make sense out of what he is, what he does, what he thinks, what he believes. If your dictionary has him believing something that's too atrociously wrong, then it's time to question the dictionary. If he says 7 plus 5 is 11, then it's time to question the dictionary. If he says there are no tables, okay, let's say he lives in the forest, and your dictionary has him saying there are no trees, then it's time to question the dictionary. Now, if your dictionary has him saying it's morally permissible to torture small children for fun, I suggest that something's gone wrong with the dictionary. This is too obvious a moral fact to get wrong, just to get wrong. So maybe when we translate morally permissible, he means condemned by the king, or against the holy writings, or came up in last week's newspaper, or something else, and doesn't mean what we mean by morally permissible. Then it could make sense. In this way, you can filter out what people propose as different cultures and different values in different cultures, because if it's really different, then we're not going to tolerate it as a plausible understanding of what the guy means. Now, you had a comment to make before.
Yeah, what if someone said that he believes that the pleasure he gets from torturing small children for fun is greater than the pain caused to the child?
Okay, so this is a very interesting case. Utilitarianism says, in one of its 342 formulations, utilitarianism says that you should act in such a way as to maximize the pleasure over pain balance of everyone who's affected by the action. Consider the following case. There are 10 people who are stranded on a South Sea Island someplace. They're cut off from all humanity, and they will remain so until they all die. Their actions will have no effect on anyone else in the world. And 9 of them would get considerable pleasure out of mildly torturing the 10th. According to utilitarianism, they're obligated to torture him. That's wrong. That's one of the standard refutations of utilitarianism. There was only one philosopher who bravely tried to hold out and said, yeah, I know it's very odd to say such a thing, but utilitarianism is so important and so strong, that was J.J.C. Smart, and he gave it up in the end as well. It's just a clear mistake. Now, a further related criticism of utilitarianism was this. Do the pleasures of a sadist count? When you're counting up and measuring what actually will bring this greatest pleasures, do the pleasures of a sadist count into the calculation? Many say no, because those pleasures are evil. Not all pleasures are morally neutral, and not all pleasures are morally positive. So this is a case where we are going to simply say that pleasure is not the right criterion for what to do. And I think that's reasonably clear. And indeed, it's reasonably clear because almost all philosophers agree. And for almost all philosophers agree, it's got to be very, very clear. If there's the slightest bit of dust, 17 philosophers will go off, you know, and bite the dust in preference to the clear truth. Yeah. Well, if you assumed that we made it up because it's good for us, then I think you're right. But I don't think that's a correct statement historically. And perhaps even more important, that's not at all the way we experience it. We understand that we are morally obligated to do things even when they hurt, even when they cost us. Democracy, in many ways, is a very inefficient form of government and leads to all sorts of practical failures. And people will say, we know that, but it's not right to make people do things against their will unless they have a say. So even though we're losing out, democracy is the right form of government. It's morally required, because otherwise you're pushing people around in a way that you shouldn't. So I don't think it's true that morality is just cooked up to make things easier for us. We certainly don't experience it that way. If I can get away with a crime, and no one will know, people are not going to say, oh, well, in that case, it's okay, because after all, the whole thing was cooked up only to make profit, and you can make profit with the crime. No one's going to say that.
No, but he's not necessarily wrong by doing it.
Why? Oh, surely my ability to stop him doesn't determine whether he's right or wrong. Criminals do get away with... Okay, but now the fact that he feels it's okay doesn't mean it is okay. People make mistakes about all sorts of things. And when I say that he's wrong, capital W, I'm not making some obviously invalid move. I'm saying that by objective standards, he's wrong. The fact that he feels different just means that he's making a mistake.
What is that based on? What is the assumption that it's a mistake based on?
Okay, so now suppose I say... it's based on the objectivity of my concept. And if you ask me what that's based on, I say, I don't know. I don't know. That doesn't mean it's not objective. That just means I can't prove that it's objective. Or I can't explain its objectivity. That doesn't mean it's not objective. Suppose you ask someone 150 years ago, how much is 7 plus 5? I use that example because Kant used it, and I'm sort of stuck on it. Right? And he says 12. Now you say to him, prove it. Prove that 7 plus 5 is 12. 150 years ago, there was no way to do that. Number theory hadn't been invented yet. Does that mean it's just invented for our good? Or if somebody says it's 11, there's nothing you can say to him? What you say to him is, it's definitely 12. It's obviously 12. You say you're 11, you're wrong. And if you ask me why you're wrong, I can't tell you. That doesn't mean you're not wrong. Bertrand Russell challenged us as follows. Prove the universe is more than 5 minutes old. 5 minutes old. So you say, well, I remember yesterday. No, prove that you didn't come into existence 5 minutes ago with those pseudo-memories programmed into your brain. Is there anything you could do to prove the universe is more than 5 minutes old? Russell said no, and to this date, I don't think anybody has a good answer to him. Should you then say that maybe it isn't more than 5 minutes old? Surely what you should say is, of course it's more than 5 minutes old, I just can't tell you how I know. There are things that I know that I cannot explain to you how I know. The fact that I can't explain how I know doesn't mean that I don't know. The skeptic is playing an invalid game here. The fact that I can't prove it doesn't mean it isn't true. The fact that I can't prove it doesn't mean that I haven't got a right to believe it and maintain it as correct. It may be that it's right, correct, and justified without my being able to articulate why it's justified. The scientific method. There is no agreed upon explanation for why one should use the scientific method. Is a person free for then saying that I won't use it? Suppose he's a doctor treating you, and you end up with some horrible result, and he says, well, I just didn't use the scientific method, because, after all, no one's got a proof of why I should use it. That won't be acceptable. Because everybody knows it's right. It's just a research problem to explain why it's right. The fact that we haven't explained why it's right doesn't reduce our conviction that it is right. It doesn't even reduce the appropriateness of our conviction that it is right.
But morality is taught to you, isn't it? By like how you grow up and by people, isn't it trained to you? So if someone's not trained to live by that standard, then they're not. You can't expect them to live by it.
Well, but that's not the issue we were talking about. By the way, notice that you were trained in arithmetic also, right? Yes, you were taught arithmetic as a little child. You did arithmetic puzzles and you were judged by them, right? Your authority for 7 plus 5 is 12 is not that Miss Jones told me so in second grade, right? Your authority is that you understand that it's true. Okay, it took a while for you to understand it, and part of that was exercises that you had to learn how to do. But you don't rely on, that's called the genetic fallacy. That is, if that's how you learned it, then that's the only validity that it has. That's certainly not correct. It's not correct for anything. And now, the same is true of arithmetic. There are cultures, they say, without arithmetic. There are cultures that count 1, 2, 3, many. After that, they don't have any more numbers, right? They don't say 7 plus 5 is 12. They don't disagree about 7 plus 5. They have no judgment about 7 plus 5. They don't understand 7 plus 5, right? That's not a disagreement. That's just that they aren't applying themselves to that question at all because it's not part of their conceptual scheme, right? A culture that doesn't play chess is not disagreeing with us about chess strategy. It's just not playing the game. Yeah.
When communities or cultures share something, such as the United Nations, would you say there's some type of objectivity there, in which to make judgments on the other communities?
This is very tricky. This is very tricky. First of all, philosophers with a love for multisyllabic words and highfalutin things talk about intersubjectivity. Intersubjectivity means that people from different points of view agree on it. Now, that's not a substitute for objectivity for two reasons. Or maybe it boils down to one reason. First of all, let's suppose that everybody agrees. That don't make it right. It may be that at a later stage, everybody has to change. So, it can't be the same as objectivity. Even if everybody agrees, it could be wrong. And second of all, the way you put it, let's suppose, I think there are 176 nations in the United Nations. Now suppose 175-1. Why can't the one say, we just disagree with you guys, and we claim that you guys are all making a mistake. That's not really unanimous. And if we're unanimous, then you wouldn't apply it to anybody because everybody would be agreeing. So I don't think that what we use intersubjectivity as is a check to see that my belief or my position shouldn't be too subjective. And it can help improve your position. It can wean you away from your narrow subjectivity. But as a guarantee that it's going to be really objectively correct, it doesn't work. Are we together? Yeah, John. Okay, I'll tell you what Gilbert Harman at Princeton says. I was really impressed. He's an impressive philosopher altogether, but he made a beautiful distinction between logic and reasoning. And it's a worthwhile thing to know. Logic is the study of what arguments are valid and what arguments are not valid. When do the premises really imply the conclusion? Reasoning is what you should do to improve your beliefs. Logic is a tool that you use in reasoning, but logic can be used in a variety of ways, and sometimes what's illogical might still be the best reasoning. For example, suppose A implies B. Now, I'm trying to improve my beliefs, and I find myself believing A and rejecting B. So, I'm in trouble, but there are two ways out. I can change myself to accept B, or I can change myself to reject A. Logic doesn't tell me which one to do. It just says you're in trouble if you believe both A, if you believe A and reject B. Then tell me which way to go. Reasoning has a lot more to be responsible for than just discovering what's valid and what isn't valid. And there are even cases when it might be appropriate to accept a contradiction and believe it. This is what's called the lottery fallacy. The lottery argument, I should say. Suppose you have a lottery with 1 million tickets. Or if that's too likely, make it 1 billion tickets. Now I got one ticket. Do you believe that this ticket will lose? That 1 billion is not enough, make it 1 trillion tickets. At a certain point, the probability is so low, if you use probability at all to decide what to believe, you ought to believe that it's going to lose. And you should use probability to decide what to believe. Right? Okay, now that's true for each ticket. So let's say there are a trillion tickets. So for each ticket, you believe it's going to lose. That's 1 trillion beliefs, right? Now what about this belief? One of the trillion tickets will win. That you probably believe with quite high probability. You know very well that the people who run this thing do it. They do it all the time. They've done it over and over again. And they've got to pick one next Monday, and one of them is going to win. Well, they can't all be true. It can't be true that this one's going to lose, and 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 one of them's going to win. And you're best off holding on to all those beliefs because each one of them has extraordinarily high probability. So there are times when you can have an inconsistent set of beliefs, which isn't quite the same as what I said before when I said it was a contradiction, but it's a contradictory set of beliefs, and it's appropriate to believe all of them. Even though logic tells you they can't all be true, it doesn't tell you what you should do about that. So logic is an abstract study of what things imply other things, and reasoning is advice as to how to make your belief situation better, to improve it, which is much more subtle than just A implies B. It requires a lot of other... For example, suppose you believe A, and you don't believe B, and you've learned from logic that A implies B, and you don't know what to do. Should I suspend belief in both in the meantime? Or should I stick with A and stick with rejecting B, though it's a contradiction, until I have a solution that I can believe in? Logic doesn't tell you that. This requires other sorts of considerations which logic can't help you with. So logic is a very narrow study of what implies what. Right? Now, the case of the pre-logical peoples, the person is believing a contradiction, which means have a valid proof that the thing can't be true. Right? Yeah. Oh, it's late.
I think I got a little bit lost somewhere along there. It's a general Torah principle towards post-customism. It's an underlying thing that they're saying.
Okay, I didn't mention the Torah's position, but my purpose in going through this was, it's our understanding that there is a God, there is a Torah, the Creator has revealed His will for the world as a whole, not just for Jews, but for the world as a whole. And because it's the will of the Creator, with 16 qualifications, that is the objectively right path to follow. It's the objectively right values to espouse. And we will definitely be accused of violating multiculturalism. And I think our appropriate response is to an enthusiastic agreement. Yes, we are violating multiculturalism because there's no reason to worry about it. That's why I went through this.
What's that?
What was the 16 you just referred to?
No, when I said...